So we have our final speaker for the evening. I see some of you noticed the food. We'll have plenty more food tomorrow. But we have our final speaker for the evening. I don't really know a lot about her, but from everything I've heard, she's a great speaker. She's probably going to have a really good message, and I'm really excited to hear her. I just met her, actually, and she's a really nice person. So let's see. Tara.
Hi, my name's Tara. I'm a recovered drug addict. I'm really happy to be here, and I want to thank the committee for asking me to speak, and thank Dan for speaking, and anybody who's been involved with putting this together. I know it takes a lot of work and a lot of effort of a lot of people to pull it off, so thank you to everybody, and I'm really looking forward to the weekend. Okay, so my story. I was raised in Long Island, New York. I came from a very nice house. I was raised in a beautiful suburban neighborhood. I did not see alcoholism, drug addiction, nothing. I literally was raised in a perfect family. The only thing that wasn't perfect in my life growing up was I got teased mercifully at school. So now they have all this anti-bullying stuff, right? Everybody's aware of anti-bullying, and it's even worse now with the internet. But I was the tallest kid in school, and I didn't have hair on my head till I was like 8. I had like what a baby's born with, and in my generation, if you were given this medicine, tetracycline, your permanent teeth came in black, like really black. So I had black teeth, no hair. I'm the tallest kid in school. You can only imagine. You're ugly. You look like a boy. Why don't you brush your teeth? And I would go home and brush my teeth with bleach and Comet. And, you know, I feel like there was definitely something up with me from birth, because I would come home from getting tortured at school, and I'd walk through the front door, and my mother would say, "Hey, Tara, how was school today?" And I'd say, "Fine." Right? I never cried, never let them know they get to you. The walls were up immediately. And so somewhere around fourth grade, I was on the bus, and that's the worst place to be when you're getting bullied, because there's no escape, right? So somebody stuffed a wad of gum in what little hair I had, and they have this phrase where you see red, and that's actually a thing, because I remember seeing red, and then I didn't remember anything. It's like going into a red out instead of a blackout, I guess. I don't know, but when I came to, everybody was backed away from me on the bus, and a couple of kids had bloody noses, and nobody ever picked on me again. And a lot of people were like, "Yeah, good for you, that's awesome," but it really wasn't, because it became worse, because I became invisible. And I don't know if anybody can identify with that feeling at any point in your life, but that is probably the most intolerable feeling to me, like see me, notice me, right? So, you know, I'm the kid that would eat by myself in the cafeteria. Nobody talked to me on the playground. I would be literally the only kid that didn't get invited to a birthday party, you know. And I escaped into books. That was my first escape. I read constantly. I mean, under the covers with a flashlight when I was a little girl, just to make the world go away. And none of that made me an addict. None of that made me an addict, right? But what it did was it primed me for my first drug and my first drink of alcohol. It just primed me. Because what happened was, when I was 12 years old, the most popular girl in school, I used to say her name, I've gotten better, I don't anymore. She was the petite little cheerleader, you know, all the boys loved her, she played the flute. She never even like acknowledged my existence in school. And I was in gym one day, lined up in squads, sitting on the floor in size order, so I'm always last. And she turned around to me and she said, "Would you like to come over to my house after school and drink beer and smoke pot?" And I looked behind me to see who she was talking to, because she literally never said a word to me before that. And I don't say this to be funny, this is a God's honest truth. If she would have said, "A bunch of us are going to knock off a bank after school and we need a lookout, do you want to be our lookout?" I would have been there. It was the first thing anybody asked me to do, literally, was, "Do you want to drink beer and smoke pot?" So you bet your ass I showed up at her house after school. A lot of people, I hear them talk the first time they use, it's like, "Oh, I felt funnier. Oh, I could talk to boys. Oh, I felt this, felt that." I felt exactly what it said in the big book, and it was a physical feeling for me. I was 12 years old, and I remember it to this day. it was this feeling that came over me that was like, I can do me now. I can do me now. And the Big Book calls that sense of ease and comfort that comes at once, right? All of a sudden, I realized I can do me. You know, my husband hates when I say this, but it's my truth, man. I absolutely believe that drugs and alcohol saved my life. I believe I would have been a teenage suicide. Why do I say that? Because when I was in grammar school, I used to watch the teacher erase the chalk off the chalkboard and just wish that I could be the chalk and somebody could erase me and make me go away. Now, I bet I don't have a psychology degree, but I bet a psychologist would say that was suicidal thinking at a very young age, just not having the words for it, right? So I got this sense of ease and comfort, and now it's on. I can do life. And I went from being invisible to now I'm hanging out with all the cool kids, right? Hanging out with all the cool kids. I went from, you know, my consequences at the beginning where I was a straight-A student with perfect attendance. When you have no friends, guess what? You're good at school. There's nothing else to do. I mean, we weren't Netflixing back then where you could just binge watch, you know. It was like, you know, and I read my whole life, so I was very, very good at school. And that's the only thing that gave me a good feeling was getting A's, right? It was something I had control over. It's worked against me with perfectionism down the line. But so anyway, I don't even know where the hell I am. Where did I leave off? My husband doesn't listen to me. This is the man I'm married to. He doesn't listen to me. Okay. Thanks.
Straight A's.
Thanks. Straight A's. Thank you. So anyway, I go from being straight A's and having perfect attendance to straight F's and having to sign in with the attendance officer for 2.5 years. I was not allowed to go to homeroom because I was so truant, right? So those are some of my consequences. I'm engaged in high school. Wouldn't recommend that to my first boyfriend because, you know, wow, somebody likes me. If you kiss me, you have to marry me. It's still that way today. It happened 3 times. sorry. I'm not saying things didn't happen in blackouts, but, you know, aside from that, that's just who I am. You kiss me, you got to marry me. I'm that type of girl. So I'm engaged in high school to my first boyfriend, and right before this big lavish wedding that my parents planned, I find out he cheated on me. And it wasn't a delusion. It wasn't part of my paranoid thinking. It was a fact. And I tried calling off the wedding. And then, you know, I had this thought, which makes me so sad today to think of at 18 years old. This was my core belief from being bullied and told I was ugly and all this my whole life was, well, I might as well marry him anyway because who else is going to want me? So I married a man that cheated, a boy. I can't even, how do you call an 18-year-old kid a man? I married a boy that cheated on me right before the wedding because who else is going to want me? So needless to say, that marriage was set up for doomed, right? It's doomed. Now, in New York, when I was growing up, you could drink in the bars at 18. But I had never drank in the bars yet. I had drank in, like, the Sumps or the Woods or the beach or the park or the golf course, like, stuff like that if we weren't at somebody's house. So I got married, and I moved to this place called Long Beach, Long Island. If anybody was ever there back in the day, there literally was a bar on every corner in the West End. All four corners had a bar. So I moved in across the street from 2 bars. So now I'm experiencing bars for the first time. Now, because of my low self-esteem back in the 80s, I wasn't one of these girls who went to clubs. I don't even know what clubbing is, but all I knew was that was for the beautiful people, and that was not me. I liked dirty old man bars that were dark, right? Where there weren't a lot of beautiful people, per se. Not that there weren't, but I felt more comfortable there. And what I realized very quickly going out to these bars across the street is that at 4 o'clock in the morning, a lot of guys think you're attractive and want to pay attention to you. So I was like, what did I marry this idiot for? Like, look at all these guys. Like, you know, there's plenty of fish in the sea, so they say. So what did my drug addiction lead me to? It led me to being an unfaithful wife, and I totally justified that because you did it to me. That's not how I was raised. That really went against who I was as a woman. It really bothered me. But I rationalized it and justified it, and I was in love with the guy, so that made it all good. You know, that the insane thinking of going to a hotel and taking off your wedding band and putting it on the nightstand and saying, well, I'm not married right now. That made sense. I mean, it really made sense to me at the time. It sounds insane, but that was my thought at the moment. If I take off my wedding band, it doesn't count. So, you know, guilt, shame, remorse, you know, started pretty early for me. Needless to say, that marriage did not work out. We were two kids who were the only ones who had an apartment out of everybody we knew. Everybody still lived at home with their parents, so you can only imagine. Can you imagine? Whose house would you be hanging out at, right? And people were driving 40 minutes to get to Long Beach from Massapequa to hang out at our house. It wasn't a marriage. It was a disaster. My drug addiction, probably when I got separated from my husband, was at the absolute worst. I worked in Manhattan, and they used to have smoking cars on the trains back then going into Manhattan. And I used to sit there with my yellow Sony Walkman, because music is my passion, you know, and I have my Sony Walkman, and I'm sitting on the smoking car, smoking a joint on the way into the city. And then I would stand, I don't know if anybody's ever been on the on a subway in the city, but there's like these cars and they have like these two chains like in between the cars, and I would stand like in between the cars like surfing, smoking another joint, watching the lights go. You know, it's like any wrong turn, it was over, you know, but I'm not looking at it like that, you know. I am shit-faced wasted by the time I get to work. And when I first started, like you can see the progression, man. When I got a job, I was working on 60th and Madison, and they had me right up front in my fancy clothes, you know, so that I could meet the customers. And by the end, they had me locked in a room in the back. They said, don't come out during business hours unless you have to pee, and make it quick. You know, they didn't want anybody to see me. I'm going in combat boots, ripped jeans, and like, screw you. You're lucky I showed up, you know. Just crazy. So at any rate, very shortly after I got separated from my first husband, I was in a bar, and I met my second husband. Married in 6 months to the day that we met. My parents were thrilled, especially after all the money they spent on the first wedding. They got a phone call that was like, I'm going to marry this guy. The restaurant he works in is closed on Mondays. Would you rather find out before or after? Man, if my daughter did that to me. Right? But I didn't hurt anybody but myself. So I got married to my second husband, and the next 3 years were horrendous. His drug addiction and alcoholism were way worse than mine. God bless you. And I mean that. And eventually, he ended up going to a treatment center. Now, back in 1983, my sobriety date's August 24th, 1986. So in 1986, it was, I don't know if anybody's, well, some people have been around that long, but I got to tell you, it was a different ball game back then, right? So I had never heard of AA. I had never heard of the 12 steps. There weren't treatment center, halfway houses, none of this was going on. We have sitcoms now, for God's sakes, Mom, right? With everything's about recovery. Like, people are talking about it. It's common. I knew nothing about what the hell was going on when my husband got on a plane and went to Minnesota to go to treatment. Not a clue. I went out there for family week. I was 3 months pregnant, and I was brutal. I bought the sweatshirt. I survived family week. It was horrible. But I learned about alcoholism, so I thought I watched Father Martin Chalk Talk, so I guess I learned. And they recommended that I go to Al-Anon. And I was 3 months pregnant, and I was not drinking and drugging at the time. And that is not a judgment in any way, shape, or form for any women who cannot stop using during their pregnancy, because I get it. I was able to, and I'm grateful for that, but it's not a judgment. So I didn't think I had a problem, see, because I got pregnant and I was able to stop, and I can control it because I made a decision. So I had a hard time with step one for obvious reasons, but I started going to Al-Anon, and I wasn't identifying, and I love Al-Anon, and I think, you know, double winners are just that, double winners. But for me, I heard a lot of, you know, my husband didn't come home, he spent the paycheck. My husband and I was, he was my running partner. We did everything together, so I didn't have that identification, you know. So I started going to AA meetings first, And for a couple of years, I would have told you a lie, that a delusion that I totally believed was that I was going to meetings to support my husband, because the poor guy's an alcoholic and a drug addict, so the least I can do is support him and go to these Cirrhosis by the Sea meetings, as they called them. It was Serenity by the Sea, but we called it Cirrhosis by the Sea. And I believe this delusion, but let me tell you something. Our past has a big impact on who we are, and my biggest, hugest, bigger-than-life character defect is jealousy and insecurity. Because I had been cheated on, because I had been given up for adoption as an infant, not wanted, like all this stuff, like pick me, choose me, want me, you're going to leave me. And the real reason, and this is why I believe 100%, they say you have to want this to get it. You have to want this to get it. I say that's bullshit. Half the people that come in don't even know they need it. I didn't. You don't have to want it to get it. You have to want it to keep it, because it takes a lot of effort, at least for me. I have to put a lot of effort into living this design for living this way of life. But I didn't even know I needed it. I didn't want anything. But all I know is the only reason I came into AA and God used my biggest character defect to get me into a 12-step program, I went there to check out the women because I wanted to find out who was going to steal my man. That's the only reason I walked into an AA meeting. And that's the truth. And I started hearing things and I started identifying, and I really felt good when I would be there and they'd go around the circle and we'd have to introduce ourselves, and I'd be like, my name's Tara, I'm a concerned person, and everybody would laugh because that's what they called me at Family Week. We were concerned people, so I'm very concerned for all you people, not just my husband. Now I'm empathetic, so I'm concerned for all of you. And you know, but I'm really feeling better going to these meetings. So I grasped this, you know, there's open meetings and closed meetings. So I literally, at a business meeting once, said, I'd like to make a request. You know, I know you have these closed meetings for you people who are really, really sick, and but I really feel better when I come to these meetings, so do you think you could make an exception and let me come to the closed meetings as well? And the guy handed me a meeting list that was this thick for New York and said, honey, you can go to any meeting, anywhere, anytime. They had been listening to me share for months, right? So he was like, come, just come. And I'm sitting there going, these people are so gracious. I'm not even an alcoholic or a drug addict, and they're letting me come to their secret meetings. This is awesome. They really are the most loving people and just accepting. Ay, ay, ay. So fast forward, I'm going to just tell you that I have 33 years. I'm holding a 33-year coin my husband gave me. But I don't have 33 years of sobriety. I had 19 years of extreme suffering. I could tell you more about what not to do than what to do. Not that I could tell you more, but I've had more experience with what not to do than what to do. So what did it look like? They accepted me. I finally heard my story, you know, finally clicked. Oh my God, I'm one of these people. I'm all in there, right? So they said, get a sponsor. I got a sponsor. Get a home group, signed up that day. Get a commitment. Back then we could smoke in meetings. I'm cleaning out ashtrays. You know, I'm going to AA international conventions every 5 years. I'm going on retreats. I'm managing a sober nightclub. I'm going to Sober Club Meds for vacation, for God's sake. I am the poster child for the 12-step programs of the United States of America, at least. Nobody's doing this more than me, and yet I'm suicidal and want to die. And I don't understand what's wrong with me. Now, if you looked at my life from the outside, it was amazing because everything in my life got better, right? I have a husband who adores me. I have a beautiful home in Long Beach. I'm driving around a Saab convertible. I have my own business that's successful. I went back to school and got my master's degree. I have a host of friends. Like, everything on the outside, you look at my life and you'll say, it's amazing, but I don't know about the spiritual malady. I don't know what's wrong with me. And I'm believing the lie that drugs and alcohol are my problem. And once I put down drugs and alcohol, I'm going to be okay. And what I found out is when I put down drugs and alcohol, I'm a mess. Because drugs and alcohol are the solution to my problem. Just like that sense of ease and comfort I got when I first picked it up, it made everything okay. And now you take it away. And I would not wish on anybody to go through 19 years of suffering, going to meetings almost every day, having a sponsor, sponsoring people. Oh, God, did I make amends to every girl I could find. I loved on them really good. And let me tell you something. You people loved on me better than I've ever been loved on in my life. But I'm dying. And I keep believing the lie that if I get that, I'll be happy. I don't know if you can relate to that. If I get this, I'll be happy, right? So I'll give you an example of you know, being discontent. Restless, irritable, and discontent. I'll give you an example of that. I'm a car person. I love cars. Always have since I was a little girl. I'm stopped at a red light. This car pulls up next to me, a convertible with really cute surfer dudes in it. And I'm looking at the body type. I'm like, I've never seen this kind of car before. What is that? And I let him pull ahead of me, and it's a Saab Turbo 900 Turbo convertible. Black camel leather interior. If I get that car, I'll be happy. I go get that car. I don't want to tell you how much I'm spending a month for that car, but I go get that car, and I'm driving around Long Beach with the music blasting, with my bleached blonde hair. I got it going on. I am happy. This is it. That hole in my soul is filled. Until 2 weeks later, I see a candy apple red coming at me in the opposite direction, and I said, I should have got the red one. It would have went better with my blonde hair. Now I am discontent driving around for the next 3 years with a car payment because I should have got the red one. Because everything I think that's going to make me happy doesn't make me happy, and I don't know what's wrong with me. What is wrong with me? I'm not drinking. I'm not drugging. I have everything I've ever wanted, and I want to kill myself. You think you can say that with double digits in a meeting? Hell no. Hell no. And what about all my sponsees? I don't want them to lose hope just because I'm messed up. So what happens? When my daughter was 9 years old, my husband drowned. He was body surfing in a hurricane, September 18th, just a few years ago, 2003. And my whole world has changed, right? So I don't really want to dwell on that. I do have, when they say you won't regret the past, the wish to shut the door on it, I do have a regret, and I'll have it till the day I die. And I accept that I have to live with it. My daughter just didn't lose her father when she was nine. She lost both parents for a while. I was not able to handle her pain and mine. I had not gone through the steps. I was selfish and self-centered. Yes, there was a lot of grief, but it was selfish and self-centered. At a time when my nine-year-old needed her mom more than ever in her life, I was not there for her. Can't make up for that. So I have that regret. You know, I get through the first year. Everybody's like, oh, it'll get better once you get through the first whatever, whatever. Don't ever tell anybody that who's going through a major loss. Don't ever say once you get through the first anniversary. It's like people think when they get a year, something magical is going to happen in this program. Nothing magical happens. You get a year and a day. And after you go through a year of anniversary, guess what? Nothing magical happens. The grief is still there. It doesn't change it. So I was worse in year two. So I finally have this brilliant idea that I know what'll fix it. It's 2 years later. I got to find a man. Well, not a man. A husband. I do husbands. I got to find a husband. And a father for my child. Now, I go up to my friend Richie. It's been 2 years. Nobody's even asked me out for a cup of coffee. My husband, who drowned, was a detective in this very small barrier island that we lived in. And I went up to Richie, and I looked as good as I've ever looked in my entire life back then, okay? I went to the gym 6 days a week with a trainer. I mean, I had bleached blonde hair. I had a six-pack. I looked as good as I've ever looked in my life. So it wasn't the looks. So I said to Richie, what's going on? Not one guy's asked me out for even a cup of coffee. It's been 2 years. He goes, there's something wrong, all right. I said, well, please tell me so that I can fix it, you know, because... So he says, well, Tara, the entire police department of Long Beach is watching you and Carly like a hawk. There's not a man with balls in this town big enough to ask you out because if they hurt you, they're going to have to move to another state. So I was like, oh, okay. So where am I going to meet somebody, man? My life is meetings, right? I don't go to clubs. I don't go out. So somebody suggests Match.com. I don't know what the hell you young people are doing with swiping left, swiping right, fishes, this happening. I don't want to know. I got a 25-year-old daughter, okay? I don't know what you're doing. But we had Match.com. eHarmony came along down the pike, and that was too many damn questions to fill in. But anyway. So, Match.com. How do I hurt my child? I'm on a mission to find the one. If you ask me to pass the sugar at Starbucks, I'd look at you like, is he the one? If you'd say, excuse me, in the supermarket, is he the one? I am on a mission. I attract every weirdo, sicko going. Why? Because like attracts like, and I was very sick. now. The woman I am today in recovery after going through these steps and having had a spiritual awakening, if I had a kid who was 11 years old and you were dating me, you would not get to meet her until I ran a background check, until I knew everything about you, until I was confident that you were a man of integrity, that I could trust, but I would bring strangers home and have them around my kid, staying over. Mommy, please don't let him come here anymore. He scares me. Sober. Oh, yeah. Oh, how many years am I sober now? Let's see. 21. No, 17, 18. 18 years sober. My parents are seeing this. My sponsor's seeing this. Everybody's seeing this. It's insane. What I'm doing is insane. But God will use anything to get you where he wants to get you. So what happens? I start dating this guy, Brian, from my home group. Wasn't even my type, but we just ended up going to a lot of funerals together. He didn't drive. He didn't have a car. And he kissed me. Well, then you know what happens once he kissed me, so. So, anyway, my daughter loved Brian. He was great, big heart. I mean, we laughed, we had fun. I said, this could really work. And everything was going great until we hit a bump in the road. See, Brian started smoking crack again. He had never gotten a year sober. He lived at home. His mother helped buy him stuff. And now, my daughter, who was raised in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, who had never had alcohol in her house, who was raised around people like you, who's never seen anybody drunk or high, I have this guy smoking crack in my house. And my daughter's saying, Mommy, what's wrong with Brian? He's acting funny. And I'm insane. My parents know that there's a crackhead living in my house with their granddaughter, and I get the phone call. They're living in Tucson, Arizona. I am sober. This is 19 years removed from drugs and alcohol. Going to meetings every freaking day. Always had a service commitment. Always. Always had a home group. And I get a call from my parents, find us a one-bedroom condo in Long Beach that takes pets. We're moving back to New York. They literally had to move across the country because they were worried about me. I blew up my life financially. I can't even tell you, trying to fill that hole, my soul, spending money that I didn't have. I almost lost my home and caused more harm sober than I ever did. But God will use everything for good. And everybody thought Brian was the worst thing that ever happened in my life. Everybody thought he was a disaster. He was one of the best things that happened in my life. Because Brian said a statement that changed my life forever. We were sitting in the car and he said to me, hey, Ty, you know what? I never want you to lose your 19 years, but I can't stop thinking about what it'd be like if we got high together and every hair on my body stood up. I'm around it. I'm getting him in and out of crack house. I'm insane. You don't think that disease was on me? It was like a cloak. I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt I was going. I knew I was going. And at 19 years, I finally got the gift of desperation because the one thing I couldn't live with was making that girl an orphan. You may not be able to get clean and sober for somebody else, but it can give you motivation. And that gave me motivation. And I didn't want to die, and I knew I was going to die. So I called this woman I had met at a Big Book weekend, Val, in Virginia. She travels around a lot. She's not easy to get in touch with. She answered on the first ring. And I am throwing up, like literally ugly crying. I'm going to die. I don't want to die. I'm going to smoke crack. I'm around crack. I'm going to smoke crack. My daughter's father died. She's going to be an orphan. I can't even breathe. I'm snot running out. And I take a breath, finally let her say something. And she asked me the most peculiar question. After all that, this is what she says. Have you ever read the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous? You know what my response was? Didn't you hear me? I've been sober 19 years. Of course I've been to Big Book meetings. And I had, because I went to, you know, we had all different kinds of meetings. She said, honey, let me rephrase the question. Have you ever followed the specific set of directions as outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I will tell you what my answer was. And I'm embarrassed to say it, but this is the God's honest truth. There's directions in that book. It's not funny. And I'm not meaning to call anybody out. This shit isn't funny. Because you know what I've shared for years? My name is Tara, and I choose not to use today. I choose not to use today. And if I heard any of you say that, I wouldn't call you out in front of anybody, but I would pull you aside outside and say, let me ask you one thing. I wish somebody asked me the question. If you could choose, what are you doing here? Because what I learned is we've lost the power of choice. And what I learned, I mean, I was hooked at the doctor's opinion. The doctor's opinion saved my life because I'll tell you why. I struggle with this God thing, and I could talk for an hour about that, but let's just say I struggled with it. But I'm that perfectionist, right? I'm that straight-A student, so I have the sponsor, I have the commitment, I have the home group. They say, you got to get a higher power. So I didn't really want one. So they said, well, you can use Good Orderly Direction, G-O-D, or you can use Group of Drunks, G-O-D. And I didn't want anything to do with no Good Orderly Direction. So I'll go with the Group of Drunks. And for 19 years, I made a Group of Drunks my higher power. Now, you people loved on me better than anybody else, but you wouldn't have the ability to change my mind. Because I'm beyond human aid. And when I hear a doctor, a man of science who loved us, saying over and over and over again, we're beyond human aid, we're beyond human aid, we're beyond human aid. And as the other guy said, Dan before me, I'm not going to use the word he used, but we're screwed. I can't fix me. You can't fix me. You can love me, but you can't fix me. Only God can fix me. When I finally learned, it was like, no wonder why I want to kill myself. I'm making a Group of Drunks my higher power, and they never had the ability to fix me. You think I was willing at that point to believe? Hell yeah. My third step prayer was the most powerful thing. My third step experience was the most powerful thing I ever went through. My life has been changed from that moment, from despair and darkness, to the most amazing radiant light, hope, joy. I am comfortable in my own skin. It changed everything. Everything. And it was this surrender. And I'm a visual person. I'm just going to share this with you because this is what it felt like to me. I am in a plane and it's going down. I'm in a jumbo jet, right? I know I'm going to crash and burn. I'm going to smoke crack if I don't get this thing. I'm going to die. I'm the only one in the plane. The pilot has a heart attack. It's going down. The wing's on fire. There's no doubt it's going down, right? That's what the first step is. I'm going to die. I'm going to die. And God says to me, Tara, jump out of the plane. So what would a normal person do, man? I start looking around for a parachute. All right, I'll jump. I may not want to, but hell, I got no choice. I'll jump. I'm looking for a parachute. God, there's no parachute. And he says to me, Tara, jump. I got you. But I'm scared. I'm terrified. God is either everything or he's nothing. We're either all in or we're not. And I made a decision to jump that day. And in that moment of absolute fear of letting go of everything I knew, I thought I knew, was this most amazing peace that came over me, which was, shit, I don't have to figure anything out ever again. I was exhausted from trying to manage my own life. I was exhausted from trying to manage my own life. I don't know if you can identify with that, but man, I was tired. I was tired. And now I'm free. Because guess what? God caught me and he has not let go of me since. A peace that surpasses all understanding. Rocketed to the fourth dimension of existence. This stuff is real, man. I've experienced it. And let me tell you something. That was 14 years ago. And I can feel it as real telling you about it right now as I did that day, sobbing on my knees, talking to my sponsor in Virginia. I'm telling you, this shit is real. It's real. So she knew I had a powerful experience. Like, you could feel it from Virginia to New York, man. I'm telling you, it was that big. And she says, honey, this is great. This is great. I'm so happy for you. And I was so happy. And I'm sobbing like a baby. And she goes, all right, now I got to give you the bad news. It's like, bad news? Come on, let me enjoy this for a little while, man. She said, you just turned everything over to God, right? She goes, I really believe you did that with all your heart and soul, no reservation. I said, I'm all in, I'm all in, I'm all in. His way's got to be better than my way. It's got to be. She said, well, the bad news is you're totally blocked from God. Shouldn't I have known this before I jumped? You know, like. So I says, what do? I mean, I just turned everything, my will, my life, everything, my kid, my family, everything, my job, everything, everything. She says, well, that's why we got a four-step, honey. We're going to find out what's blocking you. And she described it like a PVC pipe between me and God. And I need that power to flow in and through me, in and through me. And it's clogged up with resentment and fear and jealousy and bitterness and all this crap. Judgmentalness, criticism, pride, ego. Oh, and the biggest one that I didn't think I had at all. And we have a whole separate inventory for that. I guess it's a pretty big one. Fear. Oh, my God. The evil and corroding thread, the fabric of our existence is shot through. I wasn't afraid of shit, man. Do you know the dark alleys I walked down and put holes in my hand through a wall with money, not knowing if I was getting anything back? I put myself in bad situations. I'm not afraid of shit. Well, I had to say that when I walked down that dark alley. I'm not afraid of nothing. Why? I was afraid of freaking everything. Everything. But I have a God who's bigger than any fear I ever had. And he's removed all those fears from me. You know, my biggest fear when I did my fourth step was my daughter being a drug addict or an alcoholic. Top of my list. My daughter called me one night at about 2 o'clock in the morning, drunk off her ass. She's doing drugs, she's drinking, she's not living the life I would like. I can't say who or what she is, but it's not good. She's a very smart girl, very intelligent girl. She's just blowing up her life at this point. And she calls me all drunk and she says, Mom, I need to tell you something. You need to know this. Now, already, I get up for work at 4:30 in the morning, right? So here's the selfish and self-centeredness. She goes, you never ask me, Ma, and I respect you for that. But I just need you to know I'm not doing heroin. Well, that tells me something. She's around people who are. I'm working at a treatment center at the time where kids are dying every day her age. I said, well, thanks for letting me know that, Carly. Talked to her for a couple of minutes. I got down on my knees on the side of the bed at 2-something in the morning, and I said, God, she's your daughter before she's mine. And you love her a million times more than I could ever love her. And I trust you, and I trust your plan. And I got in bed, and I put my head down on the pillow, and I went back to sleep. Now, this is how great my God is. This is how he shows up in my life. Treatment center, next day, we're doing the fourth step. We're on the fear inventory, and I'm writing on the whiteboard to give an example. And I write the number one fear, my daughter becoming a drug addict or an alcoholic, and I start bawling. It's the next morning. The next morning. And everybody's like, oh, I'm so sorry. Is your daughter a drug addict or an alcoholic? I'm like, I'm not crying because my daughter's not doing well. I'm crying because I just realized right now that God removed my number one fear because I was able to pray and get in bed and go fall back asleep. The old me would have been pacing. I have physical reactions. I would have been puking or something else. You know, I would have been waking my husband up. Bart, oh my God. Right? Do I get on a plane? Do I get her into treatment? Do I call my parents? I would have been frantic. That fear is gone. I pray for my daughter every day, but it does not consume my life. Right? This shit works. So I find out in steps 4 and 5 who I am apart from God, and it is ugly. It's ugly. And you know how they say we have to concede to our innermost self that we're real alcoholics? I knew I was an unfaithful wife. I knew I stole. I knew I was jealous. I knew I did this. Like, what am I really going to find out? But when my sponsor invited God in, and I got on a plane and flew to Virginia to do that fifth step with this woman, I was serious, man. I was still desperate. All those character defects hit me in the gut just like that first step did. The truth of who I am apart from God. That me managing my own life without drugs and alcohol, this was as good as it was ever going to get. And it wrecked me. I didn't want to be that woman for another second. So you think I wanted God to remove these things? Hell yeah. Hell yeah. God showed up in a huge way. She has me do my hour. If you don't do your hour, oh my God, please do your hour. I don't think I'd be standing here today if it wasn't for that hour. I'm not kidding. She told me to go up to her son's room. Go review everything, go over everything. And she said, now, Tara, I know there's one thing that you're not going to want to let go of. We both know what that is. We were talking about Brian. Because I still had, well, God's so great. God could get Brian sober. We could be a happy family, right? You know when you want something so bad and you know God could do it in a blink of an eye? Like, why wouldn't he? Because this is great. Like, it's going to happen eventually, right? She said, and I'm going to love you whether you're willing to let go of that or not. But let me reread this line to you. If there is something you're unwilling to let go of, we ask God to help us be willing. I go off, I look at the clock in her son's room because it is going to be 60 minutes. It is not going to be 59 and it is not going to be 61 because I'm doing this perfectly because I'm dotting every I and crossing every T, right? I go through up my review, I have 10 minutes left. I'm like, well, what am I supposed to do now? And I hear her, God spoke to her, to me. If there's something you're not willing to let go of, we ask God to help us be willing. And I tumbled to my knees and I cried out to God and I'm sobbing. I'm like, God, you know how much I want this thing with Brian to work. He's a really good guy. Carly loves him. We would just make a great family. But if this is not your will, I'm willing to let it go. Please remove this from me. And I heard, God talks to me, call me crazy, I don't care, I'll argue with you all day long, it's my truth. I heard, delete all the voicemails. Now, there's something you need to understand. My husband, PJ, who I was married to for 20 years, was a very, very romantic man. And every day he left me a message telling me, you're beautiful, I'm so lucky to be married to you, you're the most amazing, blah, 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 every day. And I got him every day and I deleted him every day. When he drowned, I didn't have one. So when I had these voicemails from Brian before he picked up, they were precious to me because when I couldn't find him and he was out there running, I'd listen to him clean and sober and I'd remember who he was. And God said, Tara, delete those voicemails. And I literally, hey, babe, delete. Hey, Tara, delete. Delete. I didn't even listen to them through. I could have gone through all that work and if I was not willing to let go of that relationship, I would have come home and smoked crack with Brian. There is not a doubt in my mind. That hour saved my life. I love him to this day. I wish him well, but I'm not obsessed. I wasn't obsessed from the minute God removed it from me. He removed it from me when I asked, right? And then I had to start making my amends. If I could change one line in the big book that has not served me well, I would rewrite one line in the big book. And I don't think there's a lot of people who would argue with me if they've had my experience. You know, we get to the promises. It says, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, and they're talking about step 9 specifically, we will be amazed before we were halfway through. Well, I was so amazed before I was halfway through that I stopped making my amends because I was amazed. So I literally think it should say, when you've made all your amends to the best of your ability, you're going to be amazed. Because I might have kept going. Because I liked being amazed. So, you know, I had to go back to New York and rectify that because now I'm living in Sedona, Arizona. I met my third husband who said he was never getting married again, but you meet me, you kiss me, you're in trouble. So anyway, made my amends. I get to live in 10. I love being self-aware today of the truth, not the delusion. Like, I love being self-aware today. And my practice is I usually 10-step with my sponsees. I think it's really important that my sponsees don't think that I'm perfect, you know, that I can call up my sponsee and say, I was really selfish, or I was a real idiot today, or I lied to somebody today. I lied to somebody at work the other day. Spiritual giant. Seriously, this lady... I got my desk at work, my new desk, and there were K-cup pods in the top drawer, and I put them in the kitchen with the other K-cup pods. And then the lady comes in the next day, and she goes, oh, I see you took over that desk. Did you happen to notice that there were K-cup pods in there? I go, no. This is just about a month ago. What would have been wrong with saying, oh, I'm so sorry. Yeah, I did. I didn't realize they were yours. I put them in the kitchen. Is that the end of the world? No, but I said, no, nothing about it. She goes, oh, well, I have this acid thing, and I have to order them special online. That's why I keep in the desk. And I'm like, well, that sucks for you. I'm really sorry. They're like, I don't know. So what do I have to do? I'm driving home. I know when you're wrong, promptly admit it. I'm not even that quick yet. I'm driving home. I call one of my sponsees. I said, I just freaking out and out lied to somebody at work. So what did I do? I brought in my special expensive K-cups, brought them in to her, And I had this picture in my head that I was going to call her into the little conference room, and I'm driving to work thinking, what a good little person in recovery I am, that I'm going to go make this amends and replace what I took. And God says, oh, no, you're not going in the little office. You're going to do it in the middle of in front of everybody. I was like, son of a bitch. And I'm new there. So I walk in, Barbara, I need to apologize to you. You know the K-cups? I did have them. They're gone. Somebody already drank them. Here's mine. I don't know why I lied to you. And she's like, oh, you don't have to apologize. I go, oh, no, I do have to apologize because you don't understand. I'm going to smoke crack if I don't apologize. But I don't say that part, you know? Because she's all confused. Why is it such a big deal to me? Because it wasn't that big of a deal to her. If you only knew. Well, they're getting to know me now. I've been there a couple of months, so they're starting to catch on, I think. And then there's step 11, you know? Step 11 excites the hell out of me. There's a word in there that excites the hell out of me. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God. What that tells me is, as good as it is right now, it can get better. And I have the most amazing, freaking amazing personal relationship with God. Like, he speaks to me. I feel his presence. I get direction. He never steers me wrong. He comforts me. He takes away my fears. Like, I am freaking in love with God. In love with God and what he's done for me. And it gets to get better. I'm sticking around. Let me tell you something. I get up at 4:35 o'clock in the morning to spend time with God every morning. And this is the way I picture it. If you have kids, well, you're all kids yourselves, but that's another story. So my daughter, right? She's 25. She comes to visit us, and she's in the guest room. She's got a bottle, an empty bottle next to her bed, so she ain't waking up like I get up early in the morning, right? So I have my breakfast, I have my coffee, I'm on the couch, and I have this anticipation. I hear her rustling around in her room, and I'm sitting there, and I can't wait to spend time with my kid. I'm so excited to see her. She walks right by me, goes, gets a cup of coffee, grunts, goes in her room and closes the door, and I'm devastated. I picture God just like that in the morning. She's up. She's up. I can't wait to spend time with her. Oh, I hope she comes and talks to me today. I hope she comes and talks to me and spends time with me today. And I don't want to walk by and disappoint God because he has done so much for me, man. So much for me. And then I get to tell other people about this in step 12, right? Holy shit. I believe that we go through steps 1 through 11 for one reason, and it's not so that I'm free. It's that I can help set you free. This is not about us. This is about getting out there and helping other people. And let me tell you something. Man, we're in a bad time right now. People are dying. There's going to be a whole generation of kids in school that have one thing in common. They lost one or two parents to drug addiction, and they're going to be raised with that. This is bullshit. People are dying. We can't sugarcoat this stuff. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps, the whole point of this is that you can have a spiritual awakening and be set free. So my job as a sponsor is to put your hand in God's hand, the God of your understanding, so that you can be free and help other people get free. And we need people on the friggin' firing lines because there's a goddamn war going on out there and people are dying and you need to be sharing the truth and letting this replicate and replicate and replicate because we need more people on the front lines. Because the government is not going to solve this. Only God can solve this. Please, I'm begging of you. I looked at your thing. I'm going to end with this. From steerage to captain's table. I have to laugh because I always end with this one thing, and it kind of goes along with from steerage to captain's table. I came into the rooms empty, and I apologize for saying, God damn God. Let me say that out loud, because I don't normally say that, and I don't want to offend God. That bothered me. So I would come, I came in with nothing, right? And it would be like, I come in with this empty plate, and you people loved on me better than I've ever been loved on in my life, and I belong and I fit in. And I got crumbs on my plate. And for 19 years, I walked around with crumbs. Look at my crumbs. I got crumbs. When you come from nothing, crumbs are good. What I didn't realize was God had an entire banquet waiting for me the whole time. And I'm walking around settling for the crumbs. Please don't settle for the crumbs. If you have not experienced, and your experience isn't going to be my experience, but if you are not lit up and on fire for what you found here, then you haven't found it yet. Keep searching. Keep seeking. Keep seeking. I love you guys. Thank you so much.